the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. This program is in the memory of John Judge, who we'll be talking about with Lewis Wolf. Lewis Wolf helped found the Covert Action Quarterly, was the editor of the Rock Creek Free Press in Washington, D.C., and a longtime colleague of truth searcher John Judge. And before we get to that, I want to thank the people who support my program and make this podcast possible. Michelle Pasco in Sacramento, James Hallwell in Santa Rosa, Mona Cobus, Michael Petty, not sure exactly where you're located, but I'm grateful for the support of each and every one of you. I'd like you to join these ranks. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com, and under my picture on the homepage, you click on the link that says sign up. You can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever fits your budget. And the best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And with it, you get a copy of the rock and roll CD by John Dist called Red Flag. In just a second, you'll hear the opening track from that CD as we launch into our interview. Also, our bonus gift for new annual subscribers in the continental U.S. include a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. I hope you'll support us because I need your support to keep this independent voice coming at you in your earbuds, on your smartphone, or however you listen. Thanks for your support. Joining me today on the Peter B. Collins podcast is Lewis Wolf, co-founder of the Covert Action Quarterly magazine, and more recently, he was the editor at the Rock Creek Free Press. Check out the lyrics of this tune by John Dist on the Red Flag CD. The song's called Vampire, and John Dist sings, "The only way to survive, keep the world alive, is expose the big lie, stare it right in the eye." Lew Wolf has been doing that for many years, and today we're going to talk in part about one of his colleagues who passed away recently, John Judge. Lew Wolf, thanks for being on the program today.
Thank you so much, Peter. I feel privileged. Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about the big picture and then talk about the work of John Judge. But this song, I think, expresses it well, that we've been living under a series of big lies since at least the Cold War. And as Chalmers Johnson articulated when he developed the term blowback and wrote his trilogy of books, we pay a price for the covert actions of the past, the lack of honesty, transparency, and, you know, as the old saw told us, once you practice, what is it? What an evil web you weave when first you practice to deceive. And so you have devoted a lot of your life to exposing the big lie. Talk a little bit about that and the state of the art today.
Well, unfortunately, the big lie is bigger than ever. and the lie, which is part of the many lies, is that the official story of every major event, actually going back to the last century in our history in this country and much of the world as well, the official story always turns out to be partially or completely a lie. And you go down the list of all the major things, major events, and we can in more recent history talk about the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which was the basis of beginning the Vietnam War. The government has now admitted that was a lie. In fact, the former Secretary of Defense admitted it on tape. And then, 9/11, of course, the Kennedy assassination. I'm sorry, out of order there. The Kennedy assassination, both the Kennedy assassinations, Malcolm X, of course, Martin Luther King, and then more recently, what happened in Oklahoma City,
mm-hmm.
what happened up in Connecticut at the school.
Yeah.
And there's a long list, probably as long as both of our arms together. The fact is that they need the big lie. They, meaning the government, of course the U.S. government, but other governments use the big lie as well to justify their agenda and their program, and whether domestically or internationally. And so that's what we're talking about.
And Lou, we're now at this state where there is this deep chasm between the official narratives and reality on so many of these events. And you checked off a list there, and I just want to be clear with you that I share your skepticism about the official narrative of every single one of those events. And yet, we risk being marginalized as tin hat conspiracy theorists. And, Cass Sunstein, a good friend of the president, married to Samantha Power, was in the White House during the first term. And, he has famously dissed so-called conspiracy theorists and talked about ways to trip them up. But the bottom line is here that conspiracies do occur, have existed. There's excellent proof in almost every one of the cases you singled out there. And yet their dominance of the propaganda machinery and ability to create a powerful narrative that even one, like the 9/11 narratives that don't square with the physical evidence and with fundamental laws of physics. Yet when one questions them, you are attacked as some kind of a crackpot. And it is relatively effective because you and I are able to have this conversation and raise these issues without being arrested and incarcerated. At the same time, the go-along, get-along members of the corporate media in this country make sure that there's never any serious challenge to the false official narratives.
Well, we are prisoners of that very mainstream media. I don't know about you, but I've given up to a fair extent reading it. I depend on alternative media. And yet sometimes we have to read and listen to the mainstream media to know their lies, to recognize them. I've made it a practice over the last 20 years to learn how to recognize disinformation in the media. And it's not all that hard. If we had time, we could discuss how to develop the eye for it and the ear for it. But the fact is that they're very good at what they do, and yet they also, I should say it, meaning the system, it's not just they as people, do it all over again, again and again and again. And I've learned that studying the CIA, for example. Their program, their means of carrying out covert operations are so similar time after time, year after year, decade after decade. That's not to say they haven't introduced all kinds of new technology which they use in these operations, but the fact is that they do it again and again And there are always patterns to it. It's the same in the mainstream media. And so I would suggest to you and your listeners that they need to, in order to function as you know, thinking people in this age of tyranny and this age of disinformation and this age of what I call a creeping fascism. And actually, it's not creeping that slowly. It's quite a strong current of it, to learn how to recognize these things.
Mm-hmm. I've used the same phrase, Lou, creeping fascism and a creeping police state, as we see the call for security based on these false narratives is used to, cut out key portions of the Bill of Rights and our constitutional contract with the government. And yet most people are pretty easily swept up in it. And, they figure, well, I don't have anything to hide, so it's okay for the government to monitor my phone calls and know who I associate with and read my Facebook posts. And it really is remarkable how in, just the last 15 years, we've seen a huge erosion of our rights. And also what my friends Peter Phillips and others at Project Censored have described as a truth emergency in this country. And I really do think that's an accurate description of where we are, that the truth is such a scarce commodity that we are in a crisis mode.
Well, it's ever so true. What we are looking at is a way of enslaving us, and I say that partly rhetorically, but partly factually. Factually, because the system is able to carry out a very mean agenda, very, abusive, doesn't even begin to describe it, agenda which affects millions and millions of people in this country and then millions of citizens elsewhere, in order to, create and expand empire globally, they have to justify it by successive operations of the kind we've just been discussing, both in our media as well as in our technological world, where now they're introducing drones in the United States, as if it's not already horrible to think how many people they're killing around the world with drones. Now, drones are being stationed and deployed inside our borders, and then you have the owner of Federal Express saying now he wants to deliver FedEx packages by drone. This is really insane. And then, of course, then on another level, we're executing people as we did last week. They did a man who was tortured to death and lived for 43 minutes, and then they executed him. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is where it's at. I have a friend who's on death row in San Quentin, James P. Anderson. He's been there 34 years. He's innocent of two murders, and I can say that not just because he says he's innocent. I've studied the case.
Mm-hmm.
And there are dozens of other cases of people on death row around the United States who have been already executed despite the presence of DNA evidence proving their innocence, despite the fact that even confessions by the real killers or people that committed the crimes, they went ahead and executed it. Troy Davis, of course, in Georgia is another example many people know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, they can do all kinds of things in the name of what they call democracy. The fact is that the democracy has been largely marginalized. And it's only a word, but it doesn't really live out in truth.
Lou, one of the activists and researchers who covered these subjects for many years passed away recently, John Judge. And John was involved with the Committee for Open Archives, the Coalition on Political Assassinations, a group called the Committee for High School Options and Information on Careers, Education, and Self-Improvement. He also was on the board of the Washington Peace Center. And I knew him as a co-founder of 9/11 Citizens Watch with Kyle Hentz. And I only met John once, but I talked to him on a number of occasions when he was arranging for some radio feeds from conferences and other sites where 9/11 was the topic. And I knew him as a gentle, thoughtful person who was very approachable. I'd like to hear more about John Judge from you, because I think you knew him far better than I.
John was a sweet and gentle man. He had an extraordinary laugh. You could hear him a block or two away. He stood so tall on principle. He believed in not just knowing, studying the truth, but he was an extraordinary researcher. One of the organizations he started and co-founded was the Coalition on Political Assassinations, or COPA. Your listeners can look it up. They studied not only the John F. Kennedy assassination and the Martin Luther King assassination, the Malcolm X assassination, and I should say also Robert Kennedy. John is the only reporter and journalist who ever went to Jonestown, Guyana,
mm-hmm.
and on the ground studied. Some of your listeners and you might remember the cover, the front cover of, I think it was Newsweek at the time, either Newsweek or Time, where they had a stack of bodies. It was a gross and gruesome picture.
Yeah.
But the fact is, John was the one who discovered that underneath what was reported at the time, about 220 bodies, there were a total of over 900 people killed there. He also, by speaking with the local medical examiner, who was a very courageous person, together with, I think, a half dozen survivors who were not killed, who described the whole timeline of what happened there, that people, many of the people who were killed, who had been lured to Jonestown by Jim Jones, a friend, I should add, of the Clinton family, Hillary and Bill Clinton.
Well, Jim Jones was cozy with all of the political leaders in San Francisco.
That's right.
And let me just talk for a moment, because that incident, the culminating incident when they mixed poison in the Kool-Aid and all of those people drank it, hit very hard in the San Francisco Bay Area. There were many people of color who were drawn to that multicultural religious cult. And, there were taxpayer inducements that were used to support the church in San Francisco and the creation of this encampment in Guyana. And so there are many, conflicting elements there and cross currents. And to this day, I cringe when people use the phrase, oh, they're drinking the Kool-Aid, because that's the vivid reminder for me of the gruesome and grisly events at Jonestown.
John, to his great credit, documented the fact that a large number of people did not drink the Kool-Aid. They refused, or they were, in those moments, refused, and so they were shot in the back of the head. And he uncovered that evidence, which has largely been left untouched by, historians. He's the only one who wrote it, and you can look up John Judge and Jonestown, and you'll find his very extensive essay on that, very well documented with hundreds of footnotes. It's truly monumental what he did in that case.
Mm-hmm. And then talk a little bit about some of his investigations of the assassinations, because when I did a little research online, he was still very actively involved in the Kennedy investigation, the JFK investigation, and participated in events in Dallas last November.
He always, every year, convened a conference with others, with scholars from all over this country, and I think there were others from other countries who came to this event in Dealey Plaza, right where it all happened, and he would convene a conference there and have these speakers. It was usually, I think, either a 2 or 3 day event. I unfortunately never was able to attend, though he invited me, but I was unable. And They really broke a lot of new ground in the research on the Kennedy assassination, you know, and finding new evidence even as recently as the last conference this past November. Unfortunately, the powers that be, as we call them, the PTB, refused for the first time, this being the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, they refused to allow the event to take place in Dealey Plaza, and they were pushed out to a parking lot, I think, two blocks away. That's the measure of how the mainstream conducts its democracy, so-called. When that event, a nonviolent event, a group of scholars who have done everything they could in all these many years since, these 50 years, to uncover what really happens, you know, when a president of the United States is assassinated, it's a pretty big deal. I'm sorry, I don't mean to be funny here. It's a serious issue. And historically, we still don't know. And that's because the government is withholding, partly because withholding still thousands and thousands of pages of the records and the secret documents, which are still classified. And one of the things John was doing over the last 15 years was to demand the release of those files. Since the film JFK by Oliver Stone came out in 1992, which, you know, American public opinion changed overnight as a result of that great film. People who never thought about it very much, if they did, they wanted more answers to their questions. Who, why, and what killed John F. Kennedy? I'm not nearly as knowledgeable as he and the other scholars on it. I've allowed them to focus on it more than I have because I've worked on more recent issues. But I think it's very central. If we are to not demand answers on such an important event as that, you know, everything else is sort of secondary, I mean, in many ways. So, John...
And Lou, let me just ask, and if you can summon, you know, your knowledge of John Judge, but it is so frustrating. And frankly, you know, I started doing radio talk shows when Nixon was president back in the early 1970s. And I spent many years talking about the Kennedy assassination. And frankly, somewhere along the way, I gave up on ever expecting to learn the truth. And I don't want to, you know, cop out or be lazy about it. But I kind of accept that the hall of mirrors that they have created that prevents us from really getting to the bottom of it is holding. And my fear is that we've reached that point about 9/11, where they have successfully misdirected, disinformed, and obfuscated to the point where there is no broad desire to really expose the truth. And, you know, even as we see former Senator Graham in Florida working to expose the Saudi connection, and we see Congress members demanding the release of that 28-page document about the Saudis, that could be a key opener. Yet we see the power of as you call it, the powers that be, to keep the vault pretty well glued shut.
It's very extraordinary that they're able to do that, but the American people, the American public, as it were, is so into the official history, so mesmerized by the official history, that that's allowed to happen. And yet, the public, the surveys, the public opinion surveys on the Kennedy assassination, as well as 9/11, shows that in some cases a numerical majority of the people do not accept the official story, but they're unwilling to look beyond that. They've sort of been willing to devote themselves to, you know, their daily lives and their needs to put money in the bank and put their kids through school and so forth, in addition to demanding answers to pretty fundamental questions historically.
And let me just give you an example. I was in Washington during the public hearings of the 9/11 Commission, the Kane-Hamilton Commission.
Right.
And Kyle Hentz brought me the very first copy of one of David Ray Griffin's books about 9/11 that I had seen. And it was interesting because we were in a room in the bottom of the Capitol where I was originating a radio program. And Nancy Pelosi, who was the speaker at the time, she was the minority leader. She had not been elected speaker
That's right.
yet. So this would have been in early 2006. I gave her a copy of David Ray Griffin's book, and I asked her to read it. And the next time I saw her, I asked her about it, and she thanked me for the book, but gave me no indication that she had cracked it open even to read one page. And so, you know, we have managed to at least get the, you know, in this case, a woman who was on the Intelligence Committee, was briefed on all the black programs, became a leader, you know, as the speaker, and so she stayed in the Gang of Eight that was briefed on all of this material. And Nancy Pelosi is a woman who went to Congress with a conscience. And in her early years, she fought every year to oppose the grant of most favored nation status to China over its human rights record. And yet, when it came to these sets of issues, she joined the pack and wouldn't break away, wouldn't ask any questions, wouldn't demand any answers. And I just offer that as an example of how you can bring truth to power, and power can say, oh, no, thank you.
Oh, my gosh, yes, you really nail it there. You know, when Donald Rumsfeld held a press conference on September 10th, 2001, and announced to the gathered journalists, it wasn't that many, it was late afternoon, I think, on that day, only 12 hours before the events unfolded, he announced that billions of dollars was missing at the Pentagon. Billions of dollars. And I'm forgetting the exact number. I think it was $20 billion or something like that. You know, that's pocket change in these days of how they talk. And to this day, we still don't know what happened, but what he announced at that press conference was quite revealing. He said, I have assigned a group of auditors, he called them my auditors, to find out where that money is. Well, those auditors, all of them Pentagon employees, I think if not mostly, entirely civilians working at the Pentagon, happened to be in the very place where whatever hit the Pentagon, we still don't know what it was, whether an aircraft or a missile or what, that's exactly where it hit. They were all killed. All the records they had there, which Rumsfeld said they would have, were all burned up. And so that's one big question still to be answered. Another question, of course, is as Richard Gage and the Architects for Engineers, and listeners who don't know, have an extraordinary video showing the events of 9/11 and how the Twin Towers were affected by chemicals and by explosions in the building. You hear audio of the firemen and the firefighters in the building. And if I may use the F word here, what the fuck are all those explosions? Those audio clips are timestamped. You know exactly when it happened, and then we know that to the second when the towers came down. Each of the towers came down successively.
Mm-hmm.
The third glaring issue is about Building 7,
right,
which, of course, the 9/11 Commission didn't even mention one time in the report.
Mm-hmm.
Why? because to them it wasn't important. That was a 47-story building, happened to be the headquarters of Rudy Giuliani, the then mayor, who was told before 9/11, you really don't want to have your headquarters there. It could be a target of some kind. Well, he insisted on having his headquarters there, including as well other agencies, CIA, FBI, Treasury Department, Secret Service, and others. They all were on the 23rd floor. And if you look at the photographs of that building, again, a 47-story skyscraper. In any city in this country, 47 stories is a big building, but compared to the Twin Towers, it was like it was half the size.
Right.
But that building came down like in its own footprint, the same as the Twin Towers came down.
In less than 10 seconds.
That's right. And 10 hours after the towers came down.
Mm-hmm.
So, and there had been evacuated. There were a couple of small office fires, you know, a couple of like wastebaskets on fire or whatever it was. The firemen had already put those fires out, had left, and then it came down. So why the... And of course, we now know that there was a large store of gold that was seen there. I've seen a photograph of some of the gold. This is under the south or north tower of the Twin Towers. There was a photograph I've seen of the gold with all these firemen standing around it after the towers came down. And the photographer, he was working for FEMA, and he was allowed access there. He took a lot of hundreds of photos. So what happened to that gold? Well, we don't know. There's so many unanswered questions. And the eyewitnesses by the thousand who have testified, what they saw. Of course, there's the famous fellow who suddenly shows up within an hour of the collapse of the towers, saying, "Oh, it was an airplane. I know what it did. That's why it came down." He had the whole story. It was like a script that he was giving. He showed up on a motorcycle, and he was like an act. Well, we later learned that he is a professional actor in Hollywood. He's still living. So, you know, there's so many pieces to this, and you know, we have, if you have 7 or 10 hours more, we could begin to discuss it, but. The whole story of 9/11 is still not known, just like the Kennedy assassination, mm-hmm. Malcolm X and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King. And
we've lost a real fighter and investigator for the truth in the death of John Judge. And
so true.
I feel sad for him that he worked so hard to try to expose the truth and did not see it in his lifetime. And I hope that we can avoid that, Lou, that you and I will be around when the truth about 9/11 is revealed.
I certainly look forward to that, although I would have to live to 100 or more, and so we'll see. John only was 66 at the time of his death, and I was with him the night before, and he was still happy. I shouldn't say happy. He was in pain. He had severe back pain, and he kept talking about it. But there was still that glint in his eye. He's still laughing. And then something, we don't know what happened when we moved him. He and his partner, Marilyn Tenenoff, a wonderful woman who works at a hospital in upstate Pennsylvania and had been his partner for 4 years. They weren't married, but they lived, shared a life together, and mm-hmm. they were very much devoted to each other. So we had to search for a way out of the hospital where he'd been, where he was taken when he had a serious stroke a month before. A very serious stroke, and his whole right side was crippled. But his left arm was waving around, and he lost most of his speech also. But they could communicate. They were actually doing his taxes. 3 days before his death, and he was still able, though he could not speak, he could tell her, you know, in answer to yes and no questions, what they had to do. You know, so he was still very much in touch, even though he was in a lot of pain. Suddenly, then, we had to move him from the hospital because he'd already been there 29 days. They had only given him 23 days to stay there under Medicare and Medicaid. We had to find what they call a subacute facility, and we finally found one. And at 4:30 that afternoon, tax day, as it were, April 15th, he was taken by ambulance, and Marilyn got a call at 11:20 p.m. John Judge is dead. Hmm. We still don't know, unless he had a second stroke. That's certainly possible, or a heart attack, or what. We don't know. There was an autopsy done by the D.C. medical examiner, but they refused to release the results. So John would have wanted, as he did on other cases, an official and alternative autopsy by independent people instead of government-connected people. So we don't know yet what killed him.
Saying
it was anything unnatural, but we still don't know.
Okay, so you're quizzical but not suspicious. Is that a way to put it?
Well, like John, we want to know the truth. Mm-hmm. And he still had years left to carry on his work. I think he could have recovered from the stroke. You know, that's why we took him to where we did, the facility, because they had physical, occupational, and speech therapy there.
Mm-hmm.
And we chose that place for that. But he never was able to get the therapy because he died. I don't know what, if you really ask me, I'm not sure yet what to say, but we're not yet getting the answers that we need.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thank you for paying tribute to your friend John Judge, and in the bigger picture, the work that he took on to try to bring America back in touch with the truth and get away from the stack of lies that really have driven so much of our government's policies in recent years. Is there I'm going to put you on the spot here, Lou, but is there a quick anecdote or a story from your experiences with John Judge that you could share with us that might reflect your memory of him?
Well, he always liked to talk about, because he was described as the foremost conspiracy theorist. I put that in quotes. And his answer to that was, this was a quote, he said, "Well, they call me a conspiracy theorist. I call them coincidence theorists." And he always would say to us that you don't have to believe in conspiracies to see somebody following you. He was not paranoid, never. In fact, he taught all of us that you can't allow that to happen. You have to keep your head pointed forward, your brain focused, and your eye very sharp, and your ear very sharp. And if anything, I certainly learned that from John, and I'll always remember his laugh. What a great man.
Lou Wolf, thank you for joining us today. It's great to talk to you here on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed this a lot.
Thanks for joining us today. I welcome your comments and feedback. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.